You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a new report finds that African-American women are voting at high rates, gaining more education, and working more than other women. Despite that, poverty and low incomes for black women are still common. We'll talk to an author of that report.
First, Wisconsin government functions on a biennial budget. That means every 2 years, lawmakers and the governor work on budget bills and hope to come to an agreement before the current budget ends on June 30th.
It might seem like when one party has the governor's office and control of both houses of the legislature that it would be a smooth process, but we've seen in the past that that's not always the case, and it isn't this year either.
WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson is with us now. He's been following the negotiations, especially on transportation. He joins us now in the studio. Sean, good to have you back.
Hey, Rob.
So it looks like we're not going to have a budget by that end of the budget period, by the deadline. That we should say, it's not a disaster when that happens in Wisconsin.
It is not, no. So in some states, if you don't have a budget in place, suddenly, the party that's not in power gets more power to control the budget. I mean, they need a supermajority to pass something, so that can lead to more gridlock potentially, or, some states would run out of money in that July 1st date. It doesn't happen in Wisconsin. What happens is the budget for the current fiscal year carries over to the next fiscal year, so the status quo continues.
And this would not be the first time we miss a budget deadline by any means in Wisconsin.
Yeah, not at all. So it used to be fairly normal that the budget would go past July 1st, mm-hmm. and then you had single-party control. Started happening in Wisconsin. You had Democrats in control of state government during the 2009 budget negotiations. It was very important to them to have the budget done on time that year. Then you had Republicans take control, and they've been in control since then. Their first couple budgets, they wanted to hit that deadline, that July 1st deadline. Last budget, that started to come off the rails a little bit. They had some bickering over transportation. Mm-hmm. It blew past the July 1st deadline. And then this time around as well, you're seeing severe disagreements over transportation, and they're going to miss that deadline.
Before we get into the particulars of those disagreements, Sean, I mean, even if suddenly they resolved all the differences and agreed on the plan 2 seconds from now, it would not be done in time to beat that deadline. Is that right?
I mean, 2 seconds from now, we could give it a shot, I suppose. There's a few days
this week.
Because
there's voting that has to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. You've got to schedule the legislature's budget committee, first of all. So they need 24 hours notice. So there's that clock that starts. The full legislature isn't scheduled to meet this week. They have a floor period available to them if they want to take it, but they're not scheduled at this point to be in. So you got to get all the members in there. It's got to go from one house to the next. It takes time. So, you just look at it realistically. July 1st is Saturday. It's probably not going to happen.
Talking to Sean Johnson about the budget delay at the state capitol now and the differences in that budget. We've talked process so far, Sean. Let's start getting into what some of the sticking points are, and let's start with what you mentioned, transportation.
Yeah, it just feels like at this point they are no closer than they were months ago, really. I mean, that's my impression looking at it from the outside. And I read an interview with, I think it was Senator Alberta Darling recently in WisPolitics, where she said essentially the same thing. We are where we were a few months ago. Just take, for example, the back and forth over transportation last week. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald floated this idea that, maybe we should borrow more to fix transportation. And Assembly Republicans said, no, I don't want to do that. We don't want to do that. That is the same argument they had more than a month ago, almost identically. The only difference is Fitzgerald put a number on it. So it doesn't seem like a lot of progress is happening in the transportation debate.
So, yeah, that's the two sides seem to be pretty entrenched. The governor and some Senate Republicans say we'll borrow more, some of what we need, and delay programs or delay projects, it sounds like. And the Assembly Republicans are saying we need another revenue source. We need to pay for this without borrowing so much.
Yeah, and I would even say that they've kind of split off into three camps at this point. I mean, Senate Republicans are definitely more closely aligned with the governor on this, but the governor said, let's borrow about $500 million, and we're going to do some projects, but we're going to delay some others, and we're going to have to be okay with that. Senate Republicans don't want to delay those projects, so they said, let's borrow some more. And that, that is at odds with Assembly Republicans, who have said throughout this process, we need a long-term answer to transportation. When they're talking about a long-term answer, they're talking about revenue, a tax or a fee to retire some of that old debt that Wisconsin has been accumulating over the past years as it continues to build over the past decade, roughly, but hasn't found any new revenue to pay for it. It keeps borrowing.
So this was the argument 2 years ago, basically. This is the argument now, and it doesn't seem like there's some kind of magic solution that's going to appear that's going to get these sides together.
No, it's very much a similar situation to what we were in 2 years ago. I mean, a lot of the same arguments going back and forth, a lot of the same players, really the governor and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, kind of the key adversaries in this, really arguing very publicly over their differences on transportation. And, you know, even down to the number of what Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald's talking about borrowing, $850 million. That's how they resolved this 2 years ago. They decided, okay, we will borrow a little bit more this time, $850 million, and we'll kind of kick this off to the next budget and we'll argue it over. I'll argue over it then. It's something that keeps repeating itself. And if they were to, you know, reach a similar agreement this time, you would have the same argument coming up a couple years from now.
Back to process. Is there what's the status of negotiations on this transportation funding element?
It's all private at this point. I mean, the legislature's budget committee will meet again when they've come to an agreement that they're pretty sure that the Assembly Republican and Senate Republican caucuses can support. They're not meeting because they're not there. And, you know, sometimes they kind of bring those negotiations out into the public, as Senator Fitzgerald did when he floated increasing borrowing to pay for transportation. But, you know, as far as we know, I guess we'll hear more about those negotiations when they're closer to a deal, and we haven't heard much.
Transportation, the biggest roadblock, it sounds like, but not the only one. Education funding, it sounds like there's still some room for argument there.
Yeah, they keep saying that they're close on education, and, you know, maybe they are compared to transportation, but they've said it for a couple weeks now. They've said, okay, we're going to meet any day now to deal with this K-12 education funding. And they haven't so far. That's the type of issue that maybe they would resolve this week before that July 1 deadline. But what they're arguing over there is, you know, how much the state should spend on schools. Really, what one sticking point seems to have come down to, what do we do to schools that have been, I guess they use the word frugal, or some of these schools that haven't, that have their property taxes are lower on average than other districts in the state. How do we help them? That's been where a lot of the focus has gone. And anytime you're talking about K-12 school funding, you're talking about people's property tax bills. And so that's why it gets complicated, how much the state spends. By spending more at the state level, you can reduce property taxes at the local level. But if you don't have that money to spend, you can't do it.
So it seems like in both these cases, transportation and funding, I mean, people have been arguing about the school funding formula for what, 20 years, 25 years? I don't know, long time.
As long as it's been around.
Transportation, this is a fundamental structural thing, and they're trying to come up with these short-term solutions. Is anybody talking about trying to dig deep into these things and come up with a long-term fix?
So there was talk about the K-12 education formula. Assembly Speaker Voss said, you know, he wants to rewrite that, and, you know, that just would be a huge undertaking. I mean, I think Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald said almost immediately, I'm not sure that there's the appetite to dig into that right now. They're in a, you know, an enviable position in this budget cycle in that they have revenue, they have money to spend on schools. The governor proposed increasing state spending on schools. Both caucuses are talking about increasing state spending on schools. So I think schools are assured to get some kind of an increase mm-hmm. in this budget. Where it's getting sticky for Republicans is that the governor kind of has this number he wants to hit on property taxes. He wants them to be lower after this budget than they were in 2014. Assembly Republicans are saying, well, what if they're just lower than they were when we took office in 2010? It's in the end, they start talking about a difference of like $11 on the typical home in Wisconsin. But that is what's holding up, you know, that type of decision is what's holding up the K-12 education package.
I'm sure we'll have more to talk to you about, Sean, as this goes on. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He came by to update us on state budget negotiations as the current budget expires this weekend. African-American women are among the hardest working people in the United States, more likely to be part of the workforce than women of any other group. They're also voting in large numbers, starting their own businesses, and steadily gaining more education.
That's according to a new report from the Domestic Workers Alliance and the Institute for Women's Policy Research. It examined the status of black women in the U.S. and found that despite gains in employment, education, and civic engagement, they're not seeing economic gains.
Chandra Childers joins us now. She's a senior research scientist at the Institute for Women's Policy Research and one of the authors of this new report. Chandra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, one of your findings in this report that stood out is how much African-American women are working. How does their workforce participation compare with other groups?
Well, only of all the largest racial ethnic groups of women, African-American women, along with women of two or more races, have the highest level of labor force participation. All other groups of women have much lower levels of labor force participation.
And what types of jobs are some of the most common? I know it's hard to generalize too much, but what are some of the most common sectors that black women are working in?
Actually, that is one of the key factors that we found in looking at levels of inequality between, for example, the earnings of black women and women overall and with white men. So a large portion of women are really concentrated into service sector occupations. Many of them are in healthcare occupations, healthcare support occupations, and those tend to be jobs that have some of the lowest pay of all jobs. So, you know, here we're talking about things like nursing, psychiatric and home health aides, food servers. We're talking about also in areas like child care, personal and home care aides. So these are the types of jobs that black women tend to be really overrepresented in. And these are also jobs that tend to pay really low wages and have workers with higher than would be expected levels of poverty.
And when we look at the overall picture, how are African-American faring in the economy compared to other groups?
If we're looking in terms of earnings, so African-American women, if you compare all groups of women, their earnings, and again, we use white men since they're the largest group in the labor market, we compare them to white men. So white women would earn 77% of what white men earn. Black women would earn just 65% of white men's earnings, and that's nationally. We did find a lot of differences by state, and so in states, for example, like Louisiana, black women earn less than half of white men's earnings. So you wind up with much lower levels of income, despite greater increases in education, despite high labor force participation rates, and you also wind up with almost a quarter of black women falling below the poverty line.
And then at the same time as we're seeing lower salaries, lower incomes for African-American women, they're more likely to be a main or the main source of income in their households. Can you talk about that?
Yes, definitely. We defined a breadwinner as either a single mother with children under age 18, so she's providing for a child, or a married mother who provides 40% or more of household income. And what we found is that among African-American women with children under age 18, 80% are breadwinners. So the incomes that black women make, 80% of women with children under age 18 are either the sole or a key income provider for their households. And one of the in this other research that we've done looking at this, if, for example, we were to close the wage gap between black women or all women, if we close the wage gap between women and men with the same level of education and working the same number of hours, we could actually cut poverty for working women in half, and we could lift more than 2.5 million children above poverty.
Now, focusing on education for a moment, you've mentioned that educational levels for black women has been going up. What kind of changes are we seeing?
Between 2004 and 2014, black women's the number of black women with a bachelor's degree or more increased by 23%. And so that was the highest rate of increase among any group of women.
Is that starting to translate into different jobs and higher incomes, even if they're not catching up at this point?
Now, yes, black women, you do see black women throughout in different occupations. You see black women in better paying occupations. However, they do tend to earn less than their counterparts. And it's that they are disproportionately concentrated in low-wage service jobs, not that they're exclusively employed in those jobs. You do have, you know, black women. The range of earnings of black women, it's not as wide as it is for, say, white Americans, for white men and white women. It's more truncated, but you do have some black women in, you know, upper middle class. There's, you know, some women in a range of occupations, but again, it's not as wide. They don't have as many different occupations as you would see, for example, say, white women.
One other measure that I thought was interesting, a little less directly economically related, but civic engagement and participation in the political process. How do African American women stand up there?
And with this report, we looked at data going through the 2012 election. And in 2008 and in 2012, black women had the highest rates of voter participation. But even if outside of voting, if you look at political activity, at movement to bring social change and bring improvement to our communities, black women historically and today continue to be very active in trying to bring about change and in trying to get policies that would benefit our families and communities writ large. Not just black communities, but all families and communities.
We're talking to Chandra Childers with the Institute for Women's Policy Research about a new report on African-American women in the United States, their work, their education, and their economic outcomes. So, Chandra, we have what sounds like a pretty good recipe, education going up, civically engaged group of people here, a lot of workforce participation, doing a lot of work, but as your report says, not translating into higher wages, staying in lower wages. What would it take to take all those positives and then start to see those economic outcomes improve?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, you know, talking about the jobs that black women are in, that the particular occupations and the industries that they work in, that accounts for a large share of that wage gap. So that would really require us to begin to value those jobs in the way that they should be valued. When we think about healthcare support jobs, when we think about, you know, to think of specific child care workers, nursing and home health aides. These are jobs that are important to our society. They're jobs that the health care aide jobs, for example, those are jobs that are projected to grow over time. So we're going to add more of those jobs. We're going to need more workers. So we need to properly value those jobs. Those should not be low-wage jobs. Those should not be jobs where working full-time year-round, you could still wind up living in poverty, you and your family. So we would need to properly value those jobs. But in addition to that, even again, across the occupational spectrum, across jobs, women workers generally and black women in particular tend to earn less than their male counterparts. And so, you know, in those instances, closing that gender wage gap, having policies like pay transparency, enforcing anti-discrimination laws, making sure that we're holding employers accountable. One major factor we found was unionization. Black women who are unionized have higher earnings than black women who are not. And so in right-to-work states, those right-to-work laws are also damaging for black women workers in addition to all workers. So those are just some policies, you know, being transparent in the policies for hiring, for job assignment, for pay, and for promotions. Those are some things that could really begin to make a difference.
On the unionization side, I mean, the trends overall seem to be, or have been, down for unions for people all across the United States. Do you see that as something that could change?
We see that Black women tend to be more active in unions, but you're right, unions overall are down and they're declining. But part of that is because we do have a great deal of for example, in right-to-work states, those right-to-work laws, they do not allow unions to really be competitive, and they don't allow workers to collectively bargain in a way that they could be as successful as in years before. So I think really allowing workers that right to collectively bargain and enforcing the laws that guarantee them those rights, I think those are things that we might could begin to see some change. Now, I don't know how much we could ever turn back that tide, but I do think we could definitely make progress if unions weren't facing the level of opposition that they face.
Very briefly, Chandra, as we wrap up, what would be the one biggest change that could see these numbers start to improve over the next few years?
I would say the biggest things we could do is, again, raise the minimum wage, get rid of the sub-minimum wage, and really begin to value the jobs at the lower wage jobs that workers are in.
Chandra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Chandra Childers, senior research scientist at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. She's co-author of the report we've been talking about. It's called The Status of Black Women in the United States.
The Democratic Party was dealt a blow last week following the loss of Democratic candidate John Ossoff in a special election for Georgia's 6th congressional district. The race pitted Ossoff against Republican Karen Handel, and it generated nationwide interest thanks to Ossoff's popularity in a historically red district.
Both parties treated the race in some ways as a referendum on the Trump administration, and it became the most expensive congressional race in American history. In the aftermath, Democrats are trying to learn lessons for next year's midterm elections. The party has faced a series of political losses, its leadership struggles to maintain its position as younger lawmakers enter the scene, and there seems to be a big divide between centrist and more progressive party members.
Barry Burden joins us now for a look at the future of the Democratic Party. He is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the director of the UW's Elections Research Center. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, glad to be with you.
Well, Democrats pinned a lot of hopes on a victory for John Ossoff in the Georgia 6, but he lost. Is this a big deal politically for Democrats, or is this more about a big symbolic loss?
Well, I have a hard time separating those two things. It is a big deal for the Democrats because it's demoralizing. It's a disappointment in a district that they thought they had a good shot in, one that Clinton narrowly lost in November. They put a lot of money and a lot of volunteers into that district and really made no gains. Ossoff actually did worse than Clinton did in terms of the margin between him and the Republican candidate. So I think it has a psychological effect on Democrats who have now lost a presidential election they thought they were going to win, have lost 4 consecutive special elections to the House, and generally over the last 5 or 6 years lost lots of state legislative elections, gubernatorial elections, and are sort of at a low point in terms of offices won.
So was the bar maybe too high there for Democrats, or does it tell you, well, maybe there isn't this Democratic fervor rising up in a sort of grassroots movement that has in some places been painted as a movement like that?
Well, there's certainly a movement. You saw that, I think, around the time of the inauguration when there were massive marches in Washington and then later a march on science that happened around the country. We've seen it in meetings in districts around the country where constituents are showing up and giving Republican legislators a hard time at town hall events. And in fact, in these 4 special elections over the last few weeks, Democrats have done better than you would expect by their baseline from recent elections. The Georgia 6th is the one that's maybe an exception, but in the other 3, Democrats have really outperformed what you'd expect. And so if we take those 4 races as an indicator of what's likely to happen in, say, the 2018 general election, Democrats ought to be feeling good about at least the opportunity to pick up some seats.
If you look back to the election between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, there was a lot that was said afterwards about the messaging, that Donald Trump had very voter-centered messaging, that he hit the ideas that would resonate with white working-class voters again and again, whereas Hillary Clinton's messaging was I'm with her. It wasn't directed toward any sort of movement that would affect people. So if you accept that reasoning, that Democrats were not on their game when it came to messaging, they didn't have anything resonant, is that still true? Do Democrats have a unified message now?
No, they don't. And I think that's a concern for Democrats. They really are groping and debating among themselves about whether they want a message that, say, targets Donald Trump and criticizes him, or a message that emphasizes what the party stands for, whether it's equality or working together or other messages you saw coming out of either the Clinton or Sanders campaign, or it's a defense of the Affordable Care Act and the Obama years in the White House. I think there's still real differences about which of those things the party wants to embrace, and frankly, that's a reasonably healthy thing for a party to debate. The trouble, I think, is that Democrats are overinterpreting those differences. They narrowly lost a presidential election. They actually won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College because of what happened in a few key swing states, including Wisconsin. And because of that, there's been a lot of finger-pointing and trying to figure out where to assign blame. There was a heated race for the leadership of the Democratic National Committee, whereas the Republicans won, and winning makes it a lot easier to ignore your differences. In some ways, the Republican differences are greater than the Democratic ones, but the Democratic ones have come to the surface because they're looking for a way to get back in, and it's not clear what that path will be just yet.
Barry Burden is with us right now, professor of political science at UW-Madison and director of UW's Elections Research Center, and is with us today to talk about the future of the Democratic Party. And Barry, by some accounts, a big article in The Atlantic about this, there are kind of two wings of the Democratic Party that are viable right now. One is based on identity politics, and the other is based more on economic populism as embodied by Bernie Sanders. Do you think there's a case to be made, well, either that these two are going to battle it out and one will emerge on top, or that they can somehow come together and be sort of a powerhouse for Democrats?
Well, I don't know if it will be a powerhouse, but I think those two movements will have to meld in some way. And they're partly connected. I mean, even the message you hear from Bernie Sanders, as he does rallies across the country still, including one in Columbus just yesterday, those messages are about groups being left behind and the responsibilities of those at the top and the need to bring along people who are at the economic bottom. So it has both an identity message about people in different groups, but also it's about the economy serving everyone and trying to reduce inequality and make the tax system fairer and so on. So I think those two are difficult to separate, and even though it was less tangible, I think that was part of Clinton's message in the presidential election as well. Better together or stronger together was this idea of trying to bring everybody along, but also being attentive to group differences. Democrats really, I think, can't walk away from either one of those ideas and be successful.
Do you think there's still bad blood between supporters of Bernie Sanders and supporters of Hillary Clinton?
There is some. Surveys show that most of the Sanders supporters did come around and vote for Hillary in the general election. Some of them did not. Some of them actually ended up being Trump voters. Some of them abstained. Some of them voted for Jill Stein or other alternatives. But the vast majority, probably 85 to 90%, ended up being Clinton voters. They don't necessarily think of themselves as Democrats. They think of themselves, I think, as Sanders supporters and aligned with his ideas. But most of them are going to be in the Democratic Party. The trouble right now is that the divisions between the parties are so narrow, the margins of victory are so slim, whether it's in these special elections or it was in last year's presidential election, that the Democrats really need all of those people to be on board if they're going to end up winning some elections down the road.
And let's talk about the white working class, because by many accounts, this is the group that powered Donald Trump to victory, and a group that not too many years ago would have been under the domain of Democrats. This group would have flocked to Democrats and voted with them in a voting bloc. Are Democrats making any moves to regain some of that lost ground?
They sure are. I don't know if it's the right move, but they are thinking hard about that. There have been study groups and caucuses and retreats and other meetings where the Democrats are trying to figure out how to make their message resonate with white working class voters, people in rural communities, people with less than a college degree. You know, these were groups that I think Democrats were willing to look past in the last couple of presidential elections because they thought the demography of the country was moving in a direction that in the long term would advantage them, that young people were heavily Democratic, minority populations, especially blacks and Latinos, were growing in size, their turnout levels were increasing. And if you just put together this coalition of the rising, as it's sometimes called, that would be enough for Democrats to win. And especially in the Electoral College, they thought they had sort of a blue wall of states with enough of these groups, not to guarantee victory, but to put them in a very good place going forward. But I think the loss in November really challenged all those assumptions. And now Democrats are thinking hard about how to speak to people who feel as though they've been left behind, who have been dissatisfied with their role in the economy and feel as though they've been disrespected and ignored.
You said at the beginning of that answer, you said you don't know if it's the right move. Do you think there's a different path that Democrats should be pursuing?
Well, I think there's a tension for Democrats. Unlike Republicans, the Democratic tent has always been a coalition of different groups. And those groups have not always coexisted easily. So African-Americans, Jewish voters, today young voters, urban voters, these are some of the most solidly Democratic groups, but they have somewhat different agendas and interests. And yet Democrats feel like those are the growing populations that are going to help them win elections down the road. But in the past, it had been union workers, agricultural workers, people in rural communities who were really important parts of the Democratic coalition. But to bring them back in, so to change the Democratic message or its image to appeal to those rural white voters might turn off some of the other people who are in their coalition. And so I think it's going to be a difficult balancing act for party leaders to try to bring all of those groups in simultaneously. It always has been for the Democrats.
We're talking to Barry Burden right now. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison and is the director of the UW's Elections Research Center. And he's with us today to talk about the future of the Democratic Party.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. If you are a Democrat, registered and official, or just generally sympathetic with the Democratic Party, what direction do you think the party should take to try to do better in 2018? What are your thoughts on the party as it stands now? If you are a Republican, what do you think about the state of the Democratic Party? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Love to hear from the elusive independent voters as well. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation about the future of the Democratic Party with Barry Burden, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and director of the UW's Elections Research Center.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Democratic Party as it stands now? Where should it go? If you are a voter, do you feel like the Democratic Party speaks for you or that it doesn't? What do you want to hear from them? If you are inside or outside party politics, love to hear your perspective. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Barry, in the wake of Jonathan Ossoff's loss in the Georgia 6, there were immediately opinions on Twitter and pieces online about the end of the line for Nancy Pelosi. What do you think about that in terms of leadership in the Democratic Party?
Well, there are increasingly people asking questions about whether she should continue as leader. She has been leader of the Democratic Party, I think, for 14 years in the House. That's one of the longest tenures of any Democratic leader in the history of the country, at least as long as we've had political parties. You know, I think people like Congressman Tim Ryan, who's one of the people challenging her, aren't questioning her effectiveness as a legislative leader or as a campaign activist or fundraiser, but they are questioning whether she's the right person to represent the party. And we know from the Georgia 6 special election that Republicans and allied groups with the GOP ran ads against Ossoff, essentially linking him to Pelosi. And even using the fact that he had raised money from many small donors, many of them were in California, as evidence that his heart really was not in Georgia, but he was tied to these coastal, liberal, Democratic leaders, and that he would be a handmaiden for Nancy Pelosi once he arrived in the Congress. And those messages really resonated. And I think that's what Tim Ryan and others are getting at. Even if we think she's ineffective, even if we think she's not the problem in terms of what she's done, she's become a target or a problem for the Democratic image. She's also older as leaders go, and I think there's a concern among Democrats now about trying to replace some of that old leadership, particularly in the Congress, and bring in some new blood.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Peter on the line with us from Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. I think the Democratic Party should go in the direction of Bernie Sanders and make a more explicit appeal, say that they are for the working class and they're against the billionaire class. I think if you go in the middle and just say, oh, I'm willing to work with Republicans, you end up getting nothing, like John Ossoff and Hillary Clinton. People that should feel like you're representing don't really feel like you're being represented. They really need to make a distinction that they're for the voters and not the donors. One of the main reasons why I think they're not saying that they're against the billionaires and they actually want to represent the government or they want to represent the voters is because they want to keep getting the money.
Peter, thanks a lot for those thoughts. And Barry, what do you think about that? Is there a case to be made that given the results of this election and the strength of Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders, and he still performed very well, gave her quite a run, is there the case to be made that the party should move in that direction or maybe just generally more further to the left?
Yeah, I think there are actually two issues here. One is, what kind of campaign do you want to wage operationally? Hillary Clinton waged a pretty traditional campaign in that she held fundraisers and people wrote her checks and she got money from PACs, and that's how the fundraising was pulled together. Bernie Sanders raised essentially all of his money in small donations on the internet. I don't know if he ever had a fundraiser. And that was pretty successful. He raised an amazing amount of money. And that's become a real point of difference for the, for lack of a better name, the Sanders wing of the party and the Clinton wing of the party, is what donor base we want to use to raise our funds. And that might, in fact, drive the message for the party going forward, as Peter says. I think the second thing in Peter's question is about how populist the Democrats want their message to be. It looks like populism worked pretty well for Donald Trump. There's some evidence that it worked for Democrats in the past. There was a little populism in Obama's message. There was quite a bit in Bill Clinton's message back in the 90s. Al Gore toyed with populism when he was running for president in 2000. But Clinton really did not go in that direction, at least not openly or consistently. So I think there's going to be a movement really across the board of the Democratic Party to try to embrace populism more directly in the next elections.
Well, thanks a lot for the call, Peter. And we're going to move next to Marcia in Kenosha. Hi, Marcia.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
Well, my feeling about the Democratic Party, as he was talking about, even with Bernie Sanders, they need to take a step back. They need to act more adult than a lot of the Republicans are pursuing. They don't need to call what my example was about impeachment the first time that they feel something goes wrong with Donald Trump. If they were to stand back, take it in, they would have more credibility. I'm sick of being called a liberal when I just want things to be even for everybody. But when Nancy Pelosi is not a person I want representing me. That's why Bernie Sanders was so effective. He didn't speak when, you know, he didn't hang on the bad things. He talked about the good things, what we can do if you do it in a more scientific and factual manner, as opposed to pointing fingers at each other. The Democratic Party could go a long way.
Marcia, thank you for that. And Barry, a lot of points there in Marcia's comment. But overall, what is your take on some of those?
Yeah, she's hit on a really important discussion point within the Democratic Party that's happening nowadays. You might remember at the Democratic Convention last summer, Michelle Obama gave a pretty successful speech one evening. And I think the memorable line from that was, when they go low, we go high. Sort of implying, I think, what Marcia's saying, that the other party, the Republicans, might get into personal back and forth, or we might not like how Donald Trump carries himself or interacts with people. But we're going to be above that. We're going to talk about a future for the country and be positive.
And Hillary Clinton employed some of that, quoted that line in the campaign, didn't seem to work.
She used the line. I don't know if she did what Michelle Obama would have recommended, though. Very much her advertising was criticism of Donald Trump, analysis of the Clinton advertising strategy versus other both Democratic and Republican candidates over the last four or five presidential elections shows that her ads were more personal and more negative than just about any other campaign. I don't think we remember it that way, but the truth is many of her ads were about Trump and his failings as a person, as a leader, as a candidate. So I'm not sure the Democrats know exactly which of these paths they're going to take, but it's an important consideration for them.
Is there something to be said for that overall? I'm not a partisan statement for Democrats and Republicans that there's been too much dysfunction and voters want there to be a grown-up in the room.
Voters do say that, but Trump also got a lot of traction for not acting like a grown-up in many cases, and he still does. And so that's a way to drive media coverage. You know, some of the Monday morning quarterbacking that's happened around the John Ossoff loss in Georgia has pointed out that his campaign was not really anti-Trump. It wasn't critical of the president. It didn't go after him in the way the Clinton campaign did. And yet it had the same outcome. He lost by almost the same margin that Clinton lost in that district back in November. So I think, you know, the right way forward really is still pretty elusive for the party.
Let's take one more quick call from Steve in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm an independent. I voted for Obama in 2008, voted for Clinton back in the 90s, and I actually supported Scott Walker, in 2010 just to stop the train. So I'm pretty much an independent voter, but the Democratic Party just lost me, and it wasn't just this election. It goes back, years with the whole war on women stuff and the fact, the white privilege stuff, the fact that I'm a white male, I don't have a voice. All this identity politics is really, I would never vote Democratic again.
Steve, we got to leave it there. We're out of time. But Barry, real quick comment, a couple seconds left on what Steve had to say.
Well, I think Steve represents an important demographic of people who have really engaged in a kind of backlash against where the Democrats have moved on identity, on political correctness. That was one of the themes that took Trump into the White House.
And we'll leave it there. Barry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
Barry Burden is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and the director of the UW's Elections Research Center. He's with us there to talk about the future of the Democratic Party. And you can share your thoughts about that over on the Central Time Facebook page.